Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. I spotted this video the other day on BitChute, and I watched this with great interest. This video comes from an Australian called Brendan O'Connell, and he's on the run, I believe. And Brendan O'Connell is a truth-telling Australian, and he's doing some pretty good work, pretty amazing work, regarding exposing the Jews and Israel. Now, when it comes to truth-telling, I must say that some of the Australians are in a class of their own. I would say that the god of truth-telling is Julian Assange of WikiLeaks, and he's been arrested by the British government, and that is what happens if you tell the truth. The Jewish-dominated British don't like it. But Julian Assange has done the most incredible work of all. However, I must say, some of Brendan O'Connell's stuff is good, but Julian is in a class of his own. Nobody can come even close to what he did. He did the most incredible thing in the history of the internet, and I don't think it will ever be bettered by anybody. But anyway, Brendan O'Connell put up this documentary that comes from 2010, and it's an expose of a Jew in Australia and all the crimes that he got up to. I just want to read the description on the video that Brendan O'Connell wrote, because he mentions quite a few things that are important. So this is what he wrote. This is a 2010 ABC Australia documentary, Mr. Sin, the Abe Saffron story. Now he says, and he claims, that Saffron was Israeli intelligence. I'm not so sure. I don't see anything that quite says that. But what we do have here is a criminal Jew. So let me just read some more. He says, he blackmailed most of the New South Wales and Victoria political and business class via his one-way mirrors in his brothels. Again, Brendan writes that this guy is linked to Australian and Israeli intelligence. And again, I must differ. I don't see any evidence of that. He looks like he's just a Jewish criminal. But the next sentence he says, he specialized in sexual compromise well before Jeffrey Epstein. And let me just pause here and comment. Jeffrey Epstein, we're talking about the American Jew Epstein, who was a pedophile, who was buddies with everybody who was important. And he took them to his island. And there on his island, he took them all to go and have sex. And many of them had sex with underage girls. Among the people who went there was Bill Clinton, even Donald Trump. And Prince Andrew in Britain was definitely compromised big time. But there may even have been others like Prince Harry. And the list goes on and on and on. So you had Epstein specializing in using sex as a means of blackmail. He was using sex as a method of getting all his so-called buddies into these compromising positions, and you don't know what he did with the data. Was he having them photographed? What exactly did he do? And in his case, there have been discussions about whether Mossad was involved as well, whether he was handing this over to the Mossad, which is very possible. But anyway, the bottom line is that Epstein used deviant sex, and he was doing it with all the high-level people. Now, the KGB and other intelligence agencies have also used all these kinds of games. They use women as spies, they get men into bed, and they know that sex is a very powerful way to get information out of people. But it can be used in many different ways. Now, one way of doing things is to do it like a criminal, where you encourage somebody to do something. Let's say it's either pedophilia or, let's say, gay sex. So now you get your buddy to engage in pedophilia along with you. And now he's also, let's call it a criminal or compromised. So if you want to build close bonds with people, if you are dealing with somebody that you don't know if you can trust them fully, but you need to ensure that they don't rat on you, then one way to do it is to get them compromised. So in this world where we are driven a lot by Western morality, for example, if you can get somebody to engage in child sex or boy sex or even gay sex, then that can be a useful tool if you're going to use the mass media as a means of blackmailing that person. So what happens is if that person turns on you and rats on you for something, then all you do is you make sure that that information gets out into the mass media and you destroy that person. Now, the higher ranking that person is in Western society, the more susceptible they are to this kind of action. So if it's a president, then it means that the slightest little thing that he did wrong can be used against him. And in this way, you can control people. You can control people even if you don't trust them, because you have the method whereby if they turn on you, you can also destroy them. So they then know that they can be destroyed, and so to save themselves, they then keep their mouths shut. And in this way, you can compromise people and you can corrupt people. And the KGB used to do this a lot. Even in Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe took over, ZANU-PF, they are hardcore communists, even more hardcore and dangerous than the ANC of South Africa. And they used to have spies everywhere, and they spied on everything. And they were constantly looking for your weaknesses. And they were just basically following the same rules as in the Jewish-controlled Soviet Union, communist China, etc. So if they're looking for your weaknesses, if you're a man, you might have a weakness for drink. But if you don't have a weakness for drink, you might have a weakness for women. And so it goes on. So then what you do is you try and catch them in compromising situations and you use it. Now, Epstein, lots of weird things happened around Epstein. And eventually, after a long, long time, they managed to get this Jew into jail, and they were going to put him on trial again. And then all of a sudden, very conveniently, he commits suicide. The only known film footage of him committing suicide also disappears, and everything's gone, and the trial never happens. This is very similar to the Jew in England, Lord Jana. Lord Jana was in the Parliament. Lord Jana had sex with boys in Parliament, and it took them decades to get him in front of a court, because these Jews are very sneaky and slippery, and they can wangle their way around the police and the legal system for ages. They've got tremendous power. Now, in Britain, the political system in Britain is filled with paedophiles, and I suspect that Jews are at work there. So you'll find that Britain is the land of paedophiles, especially in the Houses of Parliament. And the Jew Lord Jana had about 20 young boys, or 20 men now, who were willing to testify against him in court. And very conveniently, he dies in his sleep at his home. And that's pretty much that. And so that also does not go on trial. If you look at really big-time Jewish criminals, well, let me put it this way. If you're looking for the biggest criminals in the world, then look no further than Jews. When Jews do crime, they do crime big. Anything a Jew does, he goes big or he goes home. When these people do crime, they do it on a scale that will astound you. Several years ago, I came across a story, for example, of a Jewish woman in New York who ran a full-on crime syndicate. She spent her entire life running these criminal syndicates. That Jewish woman in New York made $200 million. $200 million from doing nothing but running her own criminal organization. And when the police finally were going to try to catch her, she had all her ducks in a row, and she obviously got a nice tip off, and she hopped across the border into Canada, and they couldn't touch her with a barge pole. And there she got away. There's the Jew Polanski, who was a very famous Hollywood producer, and he was also into boy sex. And then he fled from America, and I think he fled to Switzerland. And then he was in trouble there as well, and then he fled some more. And he was always, always one step ahead of the law. If you go and you look at the biggest financial crimes, you'll find Jews. When it comes to money and stealing on a big professional scale, nobody matches Jews. So let's just return to the story from Brendan O'Connell. Let me just read some more. The only things that I differ with Brendan O'Connell on is the notion that this guy was intimately linked to Australian intelligence. Maybe Israeli intelligence to some degree, but I can't see anything that indicates Australian intelligence. Anyway, so let's just carry on reading some more. He writes, he, Saffron, had Australian media magnate Kerry Packer on video, and Packer himself was an ace blackmailer. So in other words, he's saying that the Jew was a better blackmailer than Kerry Packer. And he continues, Kerry Packer was tasked with running Australia's casinos in cooperation with Sheldon Adelson and Israeli intelligence. Now, Sheldon Adelson is a filthy American Jew. And it continues, they are now run by James Packer, his son. James Packer is in bed with Benjamin Netanyahu, that is the Prime Minister of Israel, and on charges of bribery with Netanyahu. They are all friends with Australian media magnate Kerry Stokes, who is besties, I assume it means best friends, with the former Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop. They are both from my home state and close personal friends with Benjamin Netanyahu. So that is what Brendan O'Connell has to say. So there's a lot of dirty stuff going on there, and Jews involved with some of these Australians. So I just want to show you in this video, this documentary from 2010. It's an excellent Australian documentary, and it talks about this Jew and his career in Australia. And he was known as Mr. Sin. This Jew broke every law that he could, and when he did it, he went big. And just to let you know that his family is of Russian Jewish descent. So these are Russian Jews who ended up in Australia. Here in South Africa, I even met somebody who was of Russian Jewish descent as well. So all these Jews, wherever they go, they get up to all their Jewish nonsense. And money, some of them will do absolutely anything for money. And even those who are legal and above board, they have their moments when they go into the dark world themselves. There are many Jews who are apparently honest businessmen, but I don't think they're all that honest all the time. But there are just some who just don't give a shit, and this is one of them, Abe Saffron. This guy was a criminal from top to bottom, and you could say this guy is Australia's Epstein. But what Saffron did was he made unbelievable amounts of money. He carried on for decades. He broke every rule that he could, and he got away with it continuously over and over again. He was never caught. He only ended up going to jail decades later. And even then, they could only really nail him on tax evasion. And in the video, they explain why they chose tax evasion. But he'd done everything, including murders, and he got away with all of it. But his big secret was he set up in his brothels, he had cameras, and he had people taking photos of other people having sex, and he was building up these profiles of these people so that he could use this for blackmail. So this will give you an idea of a Jew, and a Jew just going out there and just doing anything the hell that he can. And the shocking part is how he totally corrupts the system. That's the most interesting thing. Using his sexual stuff and also other bribery, he is able to totally corrupt everybody. The police, the governors, everyone. He can get away with all sorts of things that nobody else can get away with. Also, near the end, there are instances where people interview him, and you'll see that he just looks them straight in the eye and he tells them that everything is a lie. This Jew can lie with a straight face without even batting an eyelid. This man has got absolutely no honor, no honesty at all. But don't worry, there are many Jews like this. They are a race of liars. But what is very interesting here is this guy is a bold, in-your-face liar, crook, thief, murderer, and he just breaks every rule, and he just makes money. So much money, nobody really knows how much money he's made. And right at the end of his life, he even gets out of jail quickly, and he gives large amounts of money to all his grandchildren. He travels the world, and he loves spending some time in Israel. So, a real filthy Jew for you, and this Jew will give you an idea of a big-time Jewish crook. And if you go and you look around, you'll find that there are others. But this guy was an outright hardcore criminal, real hardcore criminal. But you get the other Jews who are softer criminals who will do enormous scams, and they'll even steal billions. But this guy, Abe Saffron, here is the Epstein before Epstein. And it'll give you an idea of how these people do things. And also another thing in this that is very bizarre is at a point, one of his buddies is busy buying up blocks of apartments. And he's busy buying up apartments and driving people out of their homes. And you get a very strange situation where the police, on the one hand, have to come and evict white people from their homes. And on the other hand, Abe Saffron's nasty men come and they smash open the doors and help pull out the people. So you actually get a criminal sending his tough guys to go and grab people and chase them out of their homes because it's easier for them to do it than for the police to do it. So these poor whites are caught between a capitalist on the one hand who's got the law on his side and the Jew who's an outright criminal using his methods, and he's also helping this capitalist buddy of his. Really quite disgusting, actually. But I think the big takeaway from this, other than the sexual blackmail, is the key thing is notice the extent of the corruption. The corruption is so incredible that there's literally nothing they can do to catch this guy. In fact, the way that they catch him is itself quite a surprise. And it is only due to him not being aware of a certain thing that he gets caught. Otherwise, he's got the police so sewn up, the governors, everybody who's senior, he's got them so sewn up that it comes as a huge shock to him when they even come to visit him and catch him. Notice also he's got a daughter who loves him very much, and he just lies to his daughter, and his daughter believes daddy is beautiful and wonderful. This guy is a real dirtbag, but It's a very interesting documentary. I found it very fascinating. But this will give you an idea of how dangerous these Jews are. And they are not to be taken lightly. When these people are criminals, they are cunning, cunning criminals. The Germans, in the time of Hitler, also spoke about Jews as criminals, Jews defrauding banks and doing big scale white collar crime. And it'll give you a bit of an idea from this. You get a bit of an idea of just how nasty these Jews can be. And I can tell you that even these dishonest Jews are also helping the honest Jews. Make no mistake. There is a lot more to this than meets the eye. But what is really astounding is not only the sexual blackmail, but also how he is able to take the entire system, totally corrupt it, and he gets away with everything all the time. He breaks laws endlessly, endlessly, and he gets away with it. So, just to show you, man, these people, they are insanely crazy for money. They'll do anything for money, and it doesn't matter to them what they have to do. It is also a case of the Jews striving downwards while whites normally strive upwards, and it's a topic I'll return to. So watch this. This is a heck of a story from Australia. The Jew, Abe Saffron, Mr. Sin himself.
In an historical sense, Abe Saffron would have to be classified as Australia's most vile, amoral, and absolutely corrupt criminal.
He was a small Jewish boy from the wrong side of the tracks in Sydney's inner west. He grew up to be one of the most mysterious and slightly notorious of all Sydney colourful characters. He was utterly charming, highly intelligent, an extraordinarily accomplished businessman, and if rooting was an Australian Olympic sport, Abe would probably be a gold medalist.
I think he was named by three Royal Commissions as being the number one organised criminal in Australia.
He was the greatest manipulator of all. When it came to corruption in this state, no Mr. Biggs could equal Abe Saffron with his influence right to the top of the tree.
I'm not involved in any criminal activity whatsoever in Australia or anywhere else for that matter. I find the suggestion most offensive.
Mysterious Abe Saffron was born in 1919. The youngest son of Polish immigrants, he grew up above a draper's shop in Annandale, Sydney's inner west. 19, he was fined £5 for illegal gambling. He enlisted in 1940, gained the rank of corporal, and was given a suspended sentence for receiving stolen goods. With backing from friends of his father, he started buying hotels, and at the age of 25, he took over the most glamorous nightclub in Australia.
Walking into the resort was like walking into a slice of Hollywood. Full production numbers on stage, elegant dining, Chicken in a Basket was a big hit. The Roosevelt was where all of Sydney's social scene went to enjoy themselves, went to have a good time, and of course you could buy alcohol late into the evening even though it wasn't strictly legal.
The fact that Abe had a past only enhanced his glamour. The beautiful young Doreen Krantz caught Abe's eye. They married in 1949, but Abe insisted on one fundamental rule.
He did love her, but he told her that he couldn't stand the thought of spending the rest of his life with one person.
This meant girlfriends, and Abe had plenty. But when baby Alan came along in 1950, Doreen hoped he'd change his ways.
He only gave us 3 nights a week, that was it. He was a father those 3 nights, but the other nights he went off to his, he called it business. Of course, as I got old, I found out was business was his various mistresses.
She always hoped that he'd change, but he never, ever changed the arrangement that he made with her back then.
Abe's swinging ways came naturally, and he found he was in tune with the times when he visited America. In 1953, he teamed up with an American entrepreneur, Lee Gordon, and together they brought Frank Sinatra to Australia for the first time.
I don't know, I'm just real excited, and I'm sure it's
going to
be just wonderful.
Fine.
Abe Saffron was a man that loved to be seen as the American showman. You know, he was always photographs with beautiful showgirls, and he copied everything American. And, of course, at that stage in America, the mafia was doing exactly what I said, organising its criminal activities.
Back in Australia, Abe expanded interstate when he bought Raffles Hotel in Perth, and he now owns 6 pubs in Sydney.
The only problem with that expansion is that in those days, liquor was highly controlled and you could only really own 1 hotel.
Abe got around the 1 pub rule by getting his brothers and sisters to front for him in the 6 pubs he owned.
Abe then supplied booze for his unlicensed Roosevelt nightclub from his 6 hotels. He bought the grog from his own hotels at a great markup price and then on-sold it to the patrons illegally at the Roosevelt Club.
Abe's prosperity and playboy image were attracting attention. Church groups were demanding greater government control, and Abe, the king of sly grog, got his first bad press.
The first public event that changed the perception of Abe Saffron was when he was hauled before a royal commission into liquor activities.
Abe lied about the ownership of his pubs. The liquor commission caught him out and forced him to sell the hotels and close down the Roosevelt. Abe moved on. It was 1955 and his Las Vegas connections kept him busy. But then a second scandal. Bad press describing lurid details of his sex life. Abe's right-hand man at the time was Wayne Martin.
As the afternoon wore on, the girls naturally got down to just their underwear on. And of course, Abe and I think his brother, you know, were down to their underwear. And anyway, I think I might have been in that club too.
Sodomy was involved. I think it was described in a rather quaint term of an outrageous sexual act. And it was sodomy of Saffron with a woman.
Abe was charged with scandalous behaviour after one of the women involved went to the vice squad.
And the police prosecutor complained bitterly that there was already evidence that witnesses had been interfered with and threatened.
No one had been pinched since 1834 for it, and we beat it, yeah.
Abe retreated from the limelight. Bad publicity was bad for business. From now on, he would work behind the scenes. In 1957, the first Boeing 707 touched down in Sydney, and Abe found the United States was even closer.
Frank Sinatra 4 times, Sammy Davis Jr., Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, Fabian, Chubby Checker. I mean, the list just went on. Over 300 acts.
In Las Vegas, playground of the mob, Abe was again made welcome. He was a willing apprentice.
He was grabbing the attention of the Gambino family and of various underworld mafia types in America, because remember, their business is the business that my father was in.
Abe arrived back in Sydney and created a business model for organised crime that flourishes to this day.
Before then, they were the razor gangs and those sorts of people. They were just thugs and crooks in large numbers. Probably Saff, the one that introduced organised respectability. So he used dummies. So he used corporate structures. You know, I knew that he had many such company, shelf company names of things, and he used partners.
There was about 86 companies on this book. He said, oh, mate, you're a director of this and you're a director of that.
Wayne Martin and his best mate, Last Card Louis Benedetta, asked Abe to back them in Australia's first strip club, the Staccato.
He backed us, put us in for a percentage. Of course, we percentage, but we saw that we still got our percentage. And anyway, from that, I then went to work for Abe as his right-hand man for, well, I suppose, a good 15-odd years through trials and tribulations, funds and disasters.
In 1959, this was all brand new to Australia. But Abe's talent was in satisfying our most ancient appetites. Eventually, he had strip clubs in every major city around the country. The Pink Pussycat in Sydney was the most famous. As well as the usual punters, there was a steady stream of police that Abe paid off to keep the clubs open late.
First of all, I'm introduced to striptease when I'm like 13. I see all these naked girls cavorting around. I'm taken to the dressing room where they're completely naked and actually doing things to me because I'm the boss's son.
Doreen still hoped Abe would become a full-time husband and father, but it wasn't going to happen. Around 1960, when he was 41, Abe took up with 23-year-old variety dancer, Rita Hagenfeld. And in 1963, they had a daughter, Melissa.
As a father and daughter relationship, I couldn't have hoped for a better father. You know, this is a man that would sit in bed with me and read stories at night time. He would cuddle me to sleep. You know, I would cry to him because I left my handbag in a restaurant and I've rung the restaurant when I was 10 years of age and they haven't found it, but he said, don't worry, darling, we'll find it. And then the next morning, there it was at the end of my bed. You just don't question it. You just, you know, he created magic. How that happened, I don't know. It just happened.
Two nights with Alan and Doreen, two nights with Rita and Melissa, and the rest of the time taking care of business, the way he always did.
I think he was a sex addict. In fact, I'm convinced he was a sex addict. There's no other explanation, because I don't know how much he loved any of the women.
These were times made for Abe, and it was all about to get even better. In September 1965, Robert Askin became Premier of New South Wales. Now organised crime reached to the very top.
Gambling, I don't think you ever eliminate gambling. We've had gambling with us through the centuries. We've had prostitution with us since the year dot. And you can't eliminate those things.
The police weren't only turning a blind eye to crime at that stage. They were actually involved in it personally. You know, if the bank robberies was there, you could rest assured that the armed hold-up squad was involved in it. The prostitution was run by the vice squad. It was the same with the illegal casinos. The police used to actually provide security for all the casinos in Sydney. They, uniformed officers would guard them. Uniformed officers would take their takings to the bank and bank them in the early hours of the morning.
Although illegal, a Across the city, backroom casinos flourished, run by a coterie of criminals, including baccarat kings Dick Riley and Joe the Boss Taylor, and the prince of the track, Per Scalia. Premier Askin collected dues from all of them, and he needed a bagman.
Now, what my father did, as the money came in from all the various different enterprises, illegal enterprises that he was not running but watching over and providing the bagman services, he took his service fee out, which was usually around 10%.
And the remaining 90% went to the very top.
The payoff had to go to two places. It had to go to the Commissioner of Police and the Premier of the State. It was always those two.
The higher Abe reached, the further there was to fall, and he felt the need to protect his position.
He became, I think, I don't know whether it would be nervous, maybe that's not the right word, but concerned, or wanting insurance, if you will.
Saffron then realised that he was onto the embryo of a wonderful idea to preserve his invincibility forever.
Saffron ran a coterie of high-class prostitutes, call girls, and he gave them to his friends for free.
The Lodge 44, which was his motel, several of the rooms were just glorified brothel rooms.
But they wasn't entirely free, as it appeared, because Saffron also had the rooms that they used tapped with listening devices and also cameras. They would take pictures of what was occurring and then present them to the victim, and they were theirs from then on.
He would have over a minister, a police commissioner, businessmen, very, very high-ranking people, people of the most highest ranks.
I believe that the police commissioners and Askin were in that position.
Anything Saffron wanted to do would be given the nod, because there was invariably a compromising group of photographs.
Look, there's no doubt that Abe did use sexual favours to bolster his power. More particularly, he wasn't afraid to use it as blackmail too if it suited him.
So basically the police ran dead on anything that involved Saffron. Yeah, he never got investigated, therefore he was never prosecuted. Not only that, they protected him. He never got shot at. And his whole career, when other crime lords were dropping like ninepins around Sydney, Saffron sailed through unmolested.
The small boy from the wrong side of the tracks had grown up. His burgeoning property portfolio, which included much of King's Cross, provided a veneer of legitimacy. His contacts at the big end of town spread through businessman Sir Peter Abels and leading property developers Sir Paul Strasser, John Shirodi, and Frank Tiemann.
The big show. Come on now, ladies, half price tonight.
In 1968, R&R came to Sydney. 1,500 American soldiers fresh from the battlefields in Vietnam started hitting King's Cross every week, looking for rest and recreation. They were part of a cultural shift that was felt around the nation, and Abe's empire exploded.
At his peak, my father had over 100 brothels, 50 nightclubs, all of which traded after the normal drinking hours. If the license in one city was 12, he'd usually trade till 4 or 5 in the morning.
Abe needed a tough guy to run his Sydney clubs for him. A pugnacious Scot, Jim Anderson, seemed perfect. When a competitor tried to muscle in on Abe's turf, Jim showed his mettle, and in turn, Abe demonstrated just how influential he'd become.
They decided that the first place to have a trial run would be one of Saffron's places, which was the Venus Room. They wanted to put six girls working the bar area. And I said, that's not on.
Abe's rival sent standover man Donnie Smith to pay Jim a visit. His speciality was a lead-lined glove. Later, for a television documentary, Jim starred in his own reenactment of what took place that night.
Donnie. get out.
He did hit me, by the way. It was the best hit I've ever had. It broke my jaw. Knocked all my lovely teeth out. Cost me $20,000 all up to get them fixed.
Jim shot Donnie in the chest.
Now, unfortunately, he stood up again. And that is frightening. I then shot him in the leg, and he kept going.
Jim's third shot hit Donnie in the back as he left the club.
He was actually dead. It was just his nervous reactions were kept him going, you know.
Jim Anderson was charged with murder. But in this first very public display of Abe's power, the case was no-billed.
Now, no-bill is where the Justice Minister can determine that a case will not proceed. They never give reasons. They never have given reasons why.
As a lawyer, I have a lot of trouble understanding that, but the Attorney General at the time, Sir Kenneth McCaw, must have understood it because he no-billed him. The story is that the police investigation was most inadequate. And again, Abe owned all the police in King's Cross.
In the early 70s, under Premier Ascot, international money flooded in, fueling a business-led real estate firm. The heartbeat of Sydney has always been property development. But now the city was to be transformed into a corporate hub, and inner-city land values skyrocketed. Residents battled to save their homes, but the developers had Askin and the police in their pockets. As usual, Abe wanted to stay in the shadows, but that became difficult when the conflict reached his personal fiefdom, King's Cross. In Victoria Street, he became enmeshed in one of the most famous of Sydney's unsolved mysteries, the disappearance of Juanita Nielsen.
Juanita Nielsen joined the very active local group of people who were opposed to Frank Tiemann's redevelopment in Victoria Street.
Tiemann was very close to Abe Saffron. He was one of his card-playing mates. Very close to him.
Frank Tiemann was spending millions buying up the Victorian terrace houses, and in 1 week he evicted over 400 residents. He planned to build a series of imposing towers.
Juanita was the heiress of a large retail store family, Mark Foy's, in Sydney, and she was a bit of a rebel in the family. She set up a business in a little terrace house in 202 Victoria Street in King's Cross. Took over a newspaper that the Wayside Chapel had begun.
Juanita used her paper to campaign against the developers, while Tiemann drew on support from Askin and Saffron.
The state police were used to stand by and drag the squatters out, while doors were smashed in by thugs and standover men who'd worked around the Blue Movies and the strip joints and the massage parlours of King's Cross for people like Abe Saffron.
The bouncers, the heavies, would come down. Rather than getting evicted by a real estate agent, you get evicted by a couple of gorillas from the Venus Room. It's not the same thing. That's what made the whole thing different. There was an association between the clubs and the development.
Resident action groups, union work bands, and Juanita's determined campaign led to a standoff. And by mid-1975, Frank Tiemann was losing millions in interest repayments.
And then on the 4th of July 1975, she vanished, disappeared.
Well, she was killed. The suspicion began to fall on Saffron as being in some way behind it. That was because people knew of his close relationship with Tiemann.
David Farrell was Juanita's lover and worked with her on the paper. He was the last person known to speak to Juanita.
I spoke to her that morning when she was running late. She'd had a late night, and she was on her way to the carousel, but not out of fear.
Juanita had been invited to Abe Saffron's Carousel nightclub to discuss advertising in her paper. As this was the last reported sighting, the police may have been expected to thoroughly investigate the club.
That did not occur, and the reason that did not occur was that this was sensitive territory. This was property owned by Abe Saffron. This would have been bad for business. It would have been very bad for business.
It took police a couple of years to even interview Saffron during the Juanita investigation. And you could barely call it an interview. It was a doorstop, a chat at his home at Vaucluse.
The word around the cross was that Juanita was killed inside the carousel by Jim Anderson or other employees of Abe's. The motive for the murder? To get her out of the way so the Victoria Street development could progress. There are other stories. Juanita's death has inspired books, movies, and even an opera. It's a classic Sydney story that goes to the city's dark heart.
Abe Saffron was intrinsically linked to the Juanita case on a number of counts. One was that it was, in large part, Saffron's dossiers that caused her to be killed.
Tony Reeves believes that it all goes back to Shirley Beager, the woman with the camera behind the mirror.
Shirley Beager compiled the details of who the participants were. She was the booking agent, as it were, for the kids, the prostitutes, the showgirls, time, dates, places and names.
Reeves believes that at some point Shirley had had enough and decided she wanted to use the dossiers to escape Abe and start a new life.
She had made arrangements to meet a man at Checkers nightclub to sell them. Saffron sent her estranged husband, Sonny, to recover the documents and do whatever it takes. At that moment, policemen got out of a car. They'd seen it all happen.
According to Reeves, the policemen were tracking Shirley with an eye to a blackmail racket of their own. They got rid of her body and stored Abe's dossiers in the vault of a bank in the country town of Cooler. Then started targeting notables, including media magnate Sir Frank Packer.
Years go by, and we catch up with the Juanita Nielsen story, and a man in Parramatta Jail wrote me a letter saying that he had been hired to recover the dossiers from a bank in Coolah, west of Newcastle.
Part-time inventor and full-time criminal, William Allen Honeysett was serving 28 years for bank robbery. His obsessive letters to Reeves and others outline a conspiracy involving Shirley Beager, Abe's dossiers, the death of Juanita, and the attempt to blackmail Packer.
Packer got fed up with it, and they hired this Allen William Honeysett to go and rob the bank and recover the dossiers. He did that, copied the dossiers, and then returned to Sydney, and then was arrested.
Honeysett claimed that Sir Frank had promised to look after him.
And if he was arrested and jailed, $14,000 for each year he spent in jail, and Sir Frank Packer would use his undoubted influence to get him sprung out of jail early.
Honeysett pleaded guilty. Then his luck really did run out.
Frank Packer died.
Honeysett wrote to Sir Frank's son, Kerry, stating his case and threatening to expose all he knew.
Kerry Packer didn't want to know about this. And here was this man. Now, there's a big problem with Honeysett. He was identified, quite correctly as I understand, as a paranoid schizophrenic. Could have invented the whole story.
Looking for a way out of jail, Reeves believes Honeysett sent Abe's dossiers to Juanita Nielsen to publish, to reopen his case, with disastrous results.
And that's why Juanita got killed, because it was discovered that she had these dynamite dossiers. He called them my dossiers of dynamite, and they certainly were.
Tony Reeves suggests Juanita was lured to a meeting at a King's Cross motel.
That meeting was to be at the Lido Motel on at lunchtime on the 4th of July, 1975. And she went there, and she was killed there. And they cut her into pieces and put the pieces down an incinerator. And we know that's what happened. We absolutely know.
Was Juanita murdered because she had Abe's dossiers or because of her involvement with the Victoria Street protests? 35 years after her death, we're not really any closer to the truth. But whatever the case, it seems Abe is always there in the background.
It's been alleged that Juanita
had 16 dossiers. There's no evidence to support this. Absolutely none.
If there were dossiers, Juanita did not have them. I'm positive of that. I had the key to her safe deposit box. I was her confidant in all things.
I actually have access to those photos. Of course, I've put them in safety deposit box and I've given a copy to the police and I've let them decide what to do. I'm not in the business of really using scandal to destroy people. I just happened to get them from his estate, you know, I just found them and was just lucky, I guess.
Alan Saffron says his life would be in danger if he released the pictures, so he won't. No investigation fingered Abe or anyone else over Juanita's death. There was increasing public unease about crooked cops and politicians. When the new government of Neville Rand came to power in New South Wales in 1976, people were looking for a fresh start. 34-year-old Frank Walker was Rand's new Attorney General.
Rand's approach was basically to legalise these illegal problems that were causing so much corruption in the state. And so legalisation of casinos, that sort of thing, which ruined the business of all the crime lords that were running them.
Money from what used to be crime now went straight into government coffers, but Abe continued to prosper.
Saffron was certainly at his peak financially and peak of his power in the 70s and 80s. And maybe into the 90s. Although I didn't notice any obvious corruption around the government, but he still would have had those linkages through the bureaucracy and other places where he could get what he wanted.
Abe thrived by becoming a lender of last resort. For those having trouble with regular banks, he offered short-term loans at high interest rates, which meant he needed muscle to collect.
I was convinced that he wasn't a particularly violent person. However, he condoned violence. In other words, if someone wasn't paying a bill, he had enforcers who would go out and get the money.
Abe's power was felt around the country. With sex, booze and gambling laws liberalised, many major criminals had turned to drug supply. In South Australia, they decided to target Abe. South Australian Attorney General Peter Duncan tabled a police report which alleged Abe was involved in the heroin trade.
The drug squad were regular attenders at Abe Saffron's premises and, as I said, were provided, according to this report, with food and drink and the possibility of women as well.
Stung, Abe emerged from the shadows to meet the accusation head on. For the first time since the scandals of the early 50s, he faced the glare of publicity.
Personally, I don't know any members of the drug squad. And as far as saying that I, again, have any connection with the drug scene or drug trafficking in any way at all is a complete lie. I can't deny it strongly enough.
The fact is he was a facilitator of drugs at his clubs in Sydney, not a supplier. No doubt he would not have got that close to that coalface, but in every one of his clubs you could buy drugs.
Going public was risky for Abe. His life, his record, and his family came under scrutiny.
Presumably the general public are going to think, how can this man be honest? I mean, the charges range from betting to receiving stolen goods to having an unlicensed pistol to scandalous conduct. A lot of people are going to say, does it worry you that some of that mud sticks?
Well, of course, I was under and a misapprehension, apparently, that these matters were finished and it was over with. That, as you see yourself, it goes back many, many years. 1938 was before the war.
Alan, it must be hard for you.
Not really, because I support my father 100%. I think the allegations are shocking, absolutely shocking, And I do love my father. I love him very much. But more than I love him, I respect him. And I respect him because of the fact that I have learned business principles from him. And if it wouldn't be for my father helping me and guiding me in the correct way, then certainly I wouldn't be in any position at all.
But behind the public front, the relationship between father and son was never straightforward. And things took an interesting turn after Alan married his first wife, Susie, in 1973.
Yes, my father, Abe, had a very good relationship with my ex-wife, Susie. He was incredibly and ridiculously generous. Every time she had a child, he would give her diamonds and give her wonderful gifts, and it was just ridiculous what he was doing. A lot of people said that she was more interested in him than even me. She might have even had a bit of an affair with him. I just don't know. I can't support that with any valid thing. It's just being talked about.
Eventually, Alan left Australia and settled in Los Angeles, where he runs a talent agency. He married a second time and started a new family. After his father's death, Alan wrote a book about Abe. He called it Gentle Satan.
I got a call from a gentleman. He said, my father read your book and found it very fascinating, but it's inaccurate. Your father was a very violent man. And sure enough, he came forward with, I believe it was 5 murders that my father was directly and absolutely implicated with. One he was actually involved with, which was the brothel, and the others were just in the building of his power.
Alan is the first and only person to suggest Abe was directly and personally involved in murder.
His judgment of my father is obviously a calculated one, and how much that is for his own purpose is yet to be determined by maybe God. Who knows? He's the only one really that knows what's going on in Alan's mind.
As they grew up, Melissa and Alan only met 3 or 4 times. Alan was aware of his father's notoriety from an early age, but Melissa was on her way to school aged 13 when she saw Abe on the front page of the newspaper.
I went, wow, that's my dad. And then I started to read the headlines, and of course it was linked with the words as a criminal or Mr. Sin or the head of the mafia or words to that effect. And I think I felt shock. I felt really hurt. I didn't show my emotion on the bus. Yeah, but I cried. It was very sad. I think that I did mention it later on when things started to calm down. And he said, yes, darling. He said, there is people out there that need to print those things in order to sell newspapers. But you tell me, what do you think and what do you feel about me? I said, well, I don't think that feels true. And he said, well, then it isn't.
In 1979, the ghost train at Luna Park burnt to the ground with the loss of 7 lives, including 6 children. Once again, suspicion swirled around the Saffron name.
To unravel one of its greatest mysteries, the tragic fire of June 9, 1970...
Sydney artist Martin Sharp produced an exhibition that pointed to Abe as part of a conspiracy to take over the park.
More than 3 hours before she learned that her 2 children, aged 4 and 6, were dead, and her 29-year-old husband had also perished in this inferno.
Well, what did it say about Sydney? Well, it said that Sydney was corrupt enough for people to be confident enough to perform such an act in so publicly. And to those who knew who was behind it all, you know, they took control of Sydney that night.
There is clear evidence that Saffron wanted to take over the park. It fits in with his personality.
The park sits under the Harbour Bridge and across from the Opera House. It's extremely desirable real estate.
Do you have any connection directly or indirectly with the Luna Park site?
None at all.
The police and the coroner investigated the fire. And 5 years later, so did the National Crime Authority. All 3 declared it an accident.
The sparks from the train set alight to one of these
terps and paint impregnated pieces of canvas. That's how the fire started. People were saying Saffron was trying to get control of Luna Park, but there was nothing in that. If there was a skerrick of evidence there that Saffron was involved, he would be in jail now charged with murder.
But later, it became clear that there was a link between Abe and the company which eventually took control of the park.
There appears to have been a determined effort to hide the true family and business involvement of Saffron in the company Harbourside Amusements Park Proprietary Limited. Did you try to hide your connection?
I've got no idea who said it, but it's untrue.
Untrue or not, the mud stuck. The 80s was a tough time for Abe. His political connections started running for cover, and amid ongoing media speculation about Juanita's disappearance, he fell out with his chief lieutenant, Jim Anderson.
In the last 5 years, I have attempted to divorce myself from any association with Abe Saffron. To divorce Abe Saffron is a very painful and very expensive experience. Because most of the people that have been associated with him are in positions of great power in this country. He doesn't reach just state level, he reaches federal level.
Jim saw safety in going public, and that was the last place Abe wanted to be. His right-hand man had become a serious threat. Abe locked him out of the clubs, and pretty quickly Jim, allegedly, went broke. He claimed that Abe owed him $160,000, and he was determined he was going to get his money or get Abe.
He didn't say much to me about Abe. He was interested in protecting himself. He was an informant to me about various matters of organised crime. And indeed, on the night when he was shot at in his unit up at, in the eastern suburbs, the police came to me because they thought I might be an ex. And the marksman was an expert marksman who only missed because Jim hesitated walking through a room.
Yeah, but I think there'd be a list of people who'd want to shoot Jimmy Anderson, and though Abe may have been on it, I think there would have been quite a few others as well. Jimmy had a lot of other business interests outside Abe.
9 years after Juanita Nielsen disappeared, there was an inquest into her murder, the longest inquest in New South Wales history. Jim Anderson emerged as a prime suspect. But by revealing how Abe avoided paying tax, he diverted public attention away from himself and paved the way for Abe's downfall.
A normal bar or club, you'd have your tills working white up until your legal trading hours.
Tills working white meant that they reflected the legal and accountable situation to the tax department.
Then, say, if you're running a 12 o'clock restaurant, like the Venus Room, and we used to trade till 8 o'clock in the morning, then your black tails come into operation where there was no recorded takings from 12 o'clock onwards.
8 hours tax-free, 7 nights a week, with drinks at a premium. For the first time, an insider went on record describing Abe's accounting methods.
All of the suggestions and are untrue. Untrue, completely untrue.
At the inquest, not only did Abe deny Jim's accusations, he claimed he hardly knew the man. He also denied the developer, Frank Tiemann, was a friend. The coroner concluded Juanita had been murdered. Who did it? He couldn't say. He criticised the police investigation, saying it had been affected by an atmosphere of corruption, real or imagined. Abe may have been free of the spectre of Juanita, but he was not free of Jim Anderson. Jim had made copies of Abe's accounts.
Did you keep two sets of books to keep track of this black and white cash?
Of course.
And did you have custody of those books?
I did.
He gave them to me one night, and I put them in the back of my car, and when I was leader of the opposition, in fact, and they remained in my office for some months. obviously as an insurance, because he felt at risk and he wanted to know that he could say, look, if I get killed, the second set of books, etc.
Jim's books ended up with the National Crime Authority. This new investigative body, established by Prime Minister Bob Hawke in 1984, chose Abe Saffron as their very first target.
It didn't matter whether it was Hawke in power or anyone else in power. My father just was plain too powerful, and he was becoming too embarrassing and almost too greedy. That was my father's problem. He was so obsessed with money and power that he lost sight of reality, in the sense that you can't have that much control and that much power without scaring people, without really making them want to bring you down.
They courted Jim Anderson. They saw him as their ticket to a conviction. They needed a high-profile conviction, given that, you know, this was a newly established authority. They needed some runs on the board.
The secretive NCA collected thousands of files but revealed little publicly about Abe. They were interested in getting him on tax evasion, and Jim's books were just the ticket.
We chose what we described as the Al Capone method. We decided that the only way we would really nail him would be on the taxation evasion charge, because we reckoned that the police who would have been involved in the matters other than that could have been bought off by him and would have convenient lapses of memory when it came to going into the witness box.
I knocked on the door, he answered the door, extremely pleasant. He then turned to me and he said, and where are you from? I told him the Federal Police Force. Whereabouts in Australia did you come from? And I said, Melbourne. He then turned to another person and he asked me where that person came from, and I gave him the same answer every time. He said, what, no New South Wales police? I said, no, not one. Isn't that surprising?
Living in the house when his grandfather was arrested was Alan's eldest son, David.
His demeanour was shock, but very stoic at the same time. He was blank. He didn't answer any questions, as he normally does. He just walked, you know, got pulled into this car and driven off.
We found the books, these two books, Black Book and the White Book.
The money that was in the safe and the diamonds they never found. My grandfather had a secret compartment built into the downstairs cupboard. You had to take out the drawer, then you had to slide a panel across, then you had to slide another panel across, then it was a safe. You'd open the safe up, there'd be cash in wads of $5,000 allotments. Then there was another compartment on the drawer, which would have bags, black bags, maybe six of them, filled with diamonds, and there'd be gold Kugaran on the top. Each gold coin would be about $30,000 or $40,000. So that was his safe.
For 69-year-old Abe Saffron, it was a day he, and no doubt many others, thought would never come.
After 2 years in the courts, Abe was found guilty of tax evasion. In October 1988, at the age of 69, his journey from the Annandale draper's shop ended up in a Long Bay jail cell.
He was frightened, as anybody would be. He was facing 3 years in maximum in jail, and he wasn't a young man.
And I think that was the beginning of the end of the joyous, bubbling, vivacious character that he was full-time to this part-time character that evolved, and the sadness crept in.
When you arrest a person and they go to jail, they lose the aura about them, and that's what happened to Al Capone, that's what happened to Abe Saffron.
Well, it was difficult at first, but then they increased the size of his cell. They gave him a lot of comfort, like a sofa and a television. They treated him like a celebrity guest.
Inside, Abe did his best to live life as usual. He was still the boss, and he celebrated Christmas by organising a Chinese banquet and a performance by Lay Girls Transvestite Revue. After just 13 months, he was released from prison. But it was clear that Abe's days of influence were over. He turned to family and increasingly Terry, his last mistress.
I don't think that Doreen initially knew about my relationship with Abe. She knew that I worked for him. When she eventually found out, she was terribly angry and she never spoke to me again. She moved to Perth.
True to form, Abe split his time between Terry in Sydney and Doreen in Perth. After 52 years of marriage to Abe Saffron, Doreen died in 1999. In the final 7 years of his life, Abe sold off his business interests and lived on income from his properties.
Oh, it was great. We went on a lot of cruises. We went all around the world, really. Mediterranean, the Caribbean, Las Vegas. We went to Israel quite a bit because Abe had friends there and he loved being in Israel.
In Israel, heart problems put him in hospital. And on the way home to Australia, he had a fall in Bangkok. Back in Sydney, Abe entered St Vincent's Hospital, just down the road from King's Cross.
I was holding his hand. I used to go to the hospital every day. And he just suddenly died, just passed away. It's such a shock.
To do business, to conduct business, to be involved in business was the air he breathed. That's what kept him young, that's what kept him alive. Right up until the time he died, he was still conducting business on the phone in the hospital bed 1 week before he died. I said, Dad, you know. He says, darling, I've just got to finish. I'll be with you in a minute.
In his final years, Abe visited Allen and family in Los Angeles several times. His grandchildren in California and Australia remember a loving man who doted on them. In a morality tale, crooks are supposed to die miserable. Abe beat the odds. He spent his final days surrounded by family that loved him. To the end, he hung onto his money. Officially, his estate was $25 million. But some reports suggested figures of up to $150 million. Abe left his eight grandchildren $1 million each. Terry got property and money, and so did Melissa. Alan was given only $500,000, along with a stipulation that if he challenged the will, he would lose it.
One person said to me that there might have been a three-card Monty pulled on his will. In other words, three wills laid out, signs one and they exchange it with the other.
In 1985, the National Crime Authority's initial report on Abe alleged he was involved in bribery, corruption, prostitution, fraud, and the supply and distribution of narcotics. But because they chose the Al Capone approach, the truth or otherwise of those ongoing claims has never been tested. To this day, local, state, and federal politics is haunted by Abe's enduring legacy, the business model for organized crime that he established in Australia.
These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.